You're listening to Economics of Place, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Dan Gilmartin.
Welcome back to the Economics of Place podcast. I'm Dan Gilmartin, and we're talking to you from the Amway Grand Hotel in Grand Rapids, where the Michigan Municipal League and the Michigan Association of Planning is holding a joint meeting of over 1,000 attendees from around the state. And one of the people who's going to be addressing them today is none other than Bruce Katz, who's with Drexel University and formerly the Brookings Institute and a whole bunch of different things, here to talk about a new book he's got out and some ideas he's got to improve municipal and public finance in the country. So thanks for being here, Bruce. We're glad to have you.
It's great to be here.
Great. So tell us a little bit, before I get to the book, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, you've been sort of in and around public policy probably your entire adult life, I would imagine. But we've stumbled across each other's paths many times in looking at ways to make, you know, cities better and economies better. And take us to this point in time that brought you here to Grand Rapids.
So in some respects, I'm a recovering federal government official.
One day at a time, right?
Yeah. I started work in the federal government in the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Housing and Urban Affairs back in 1987. Mm-hmm. Stayed there through 93. At one point, Don Riegel was the chairman of the banking committee.
Michigan
so,
guy. Yeah.
So I reported to Senator Riegel and Senator Cranston and Senator Sarbanes. And then when Bill Clinton was elected, I became chief of staff to Henry Cisneros, who was then the secretary of HUD, and left after the Clinton first term to go to Brookings and start what was initially a center on cities and ultimately became a program of the Brookings Institution. And I left Brookings in March of this year to start a company with Jeremy Nowak, close friend, co-author of the book, and have just started a new Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University in honor of Jeremy. He passed at the end of July.
Right, a good guy and a real champion of this kind of work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I know in your time at Brookings, and so the portfolio was probably pretty wide in terms of making cities better. There was a housing bent and everything else, but you've kind of gravitated towards, in recent years, your work. I'm a big fan of your work. Gravitated towards sort of wealth, and not wealth in terms of personal wealth necessarily, that's a function of it, but how we get sort of funds, people, economies churning, first in large metropolitan areas, then in, you know, smaller neighborhoods, and trying to combine all those sort of new age nexus, if you will, trying to identify that between what communities need to do and how to build economies, which is different, obviously, than it was in 1950 here in Michigan. So we're the poster child for that, right? It just took you there because it was so obvious through the years, all your research, or how'd you get to that spot?
I think what I became very interested in maybe 5 or 7 years ago was, so if cities are the engines of national economies and the centers of global trade and investment, why can't we in the United States, for example, fund infrastructure, fund investments in early childhood? I mean, what's the problem here? If cities are the vanguard, what's the financing challenge? So I started spending a lot of time in Northern Europe, in Germany, in Denmark, to a lesser extent, Sweden and Finland, because I think the Northern Europeans have figured out a mechanism to unlock what we might call public wealth. Mm-hmm. They've built these publicly owned, privately managed corporations that are able to regenerate large portions of their cities, like the harbor area in Copenhagen.
So let me back up. Publicly owned, privately managed. What does that look like?
So basically what we have in the U.S. are a lot of public authorities.
Right.
Right. This is, I mean, if you read The Power Broker about Robert Moses, mm-hmm. what the most interesting chapters for me as a student of urban history are the chapters around the rise of public authorities, mm-hmm. Redevelopment authorities, stadia authorities, port authorities, airport authorities, you name it. We
downtown got districts,
downtown,
you name it. Right.
So we build public entities.
We say we hate government. We love government.
We love government. We got a ton of it. So many of these public authorities, take the New York, New Jersey Port Authority as the quintessential public authority. They are essentially affected immensely by political decisions. Mm-hmm. They are really under the thumb of the New Jersey governor and the New York governor. In Northern Europe, it works a bit differently. They are public authorities. They're publicly owned. but they're professionally managed. They're insulated from politics. And so when the Copenhagen City and Port Development Corporation is driving the redevelopment of the harbor area of Copenhagen, by national law, all the revenues from that regeneration, the value captured to some to a great extent, goes to service the debt on a citywide transit system. Oh. So this is the virtuous cycle in Northern Europe. This is why Hamburg looks the way it does in Denmark. It's not just cultural. It's not just because they like to cycle.
Right. So they take a brownfield area. They turn it around. They make it into a housing development or a commercial development, sell it for $100 million US, and that goes into basically the entire public infrastructure kitty to help with everything.
In Copenhagen, it goes to build a citywide transit system. In Hamburg, in Hafen City, it goes to keep making that portion of a greater downtown more viable, more environmentally sustainable, more inclusive.
Which, with a few exceptions, is 180 degree difference than how we do it here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we do have some public authority. I would say the Philadelphia Industrial Development Corporation, which has redeveloped the Navy Yard in Philadelphia, is a very well-run institution. The difference between the Danes or the Germans is they would like right now to extend the transit system from the Philadelphia Stadia down to the Navy Yard. So they need $400 million to do it. In Europe, it would be financed from the value, the appreciation of value in that area. In the U.S., we don't really have a mechanism
for that. So the Navy Yard, if there is value there, it stays in the Navy Yard.
It stays in the Navy Yard.
Our downtown authorities in Michigan, all the TIF districts and everything else that we've got here, you don't take that money and spend it over here because there's a greater need. It stays right where it is, and that's its own authority.
Absolutely.
And actually has very little, if any, linkage to the authority right next door doing something different. It'd be water or roads or whatever it is.
So we have fragmented governance, and we haven't really created a mechanism in the U.S. for creating value, capturing value for the public benefit. And so I think going forward, since the national government is in a complete state of dysfunction, and frankly, given the demographic transformation of the country, is going to spend more and more and more on the elderly with less room to invest in the future around infrastructure, around inclusion, around innovation. It's going to fall to the local and the metropolitan level to fund the future. And that's what drove me to Northern Europe to figure out, is there a way to finance the future with these smart public-private institutions that have been created there? We do public-private transactions in the U.S. They do public-private institutions.
Right.
And therein lies all the difference.
Which is much more strategic.
Exactly.
I would say in this in this state, we've talked a lot about service sharing and consolidation, those types of things, but it's always in a transactional matter. It's always about, combine the road authorities or, get two cities together and only have to hire one police chief or something like that. And actually, the economies of scale don't necessarily work there because so much of what government does is transactional. And if you're going to pave a mile of road, it's going to cost you a mile of road no matter who's paving it. And a cop costs so much no matter what his or her patch looks like on their shoulder when they show up at a traffic stop or something like that. But what we don't have are these strategic regional conversations about leveraging the wonderful bedroom community with the downtown neighborhood, with the commercial corridor, with the transportation program and job training. I mean, you keep going to your, you keep going to you forget what you're talking about. But that's where I always thought we've been the big miss. It's been more of a game of gotcha regionalism as opposed to what you're talking about they do in Northern Europe, which is, quite frankly, that's probably the private sector vision coming through, right? I mean, that's the whole
thought of it. I think what's really interesting to me is also, when we talk about the Germans or the Danes or the Dutch, we're talking about social democrats, social democratic parties that are literally to the far left of our Democratic Party. But they
real lefties.
With real lefties, right?
Not this just is lefties the, here and there.
The Bernie Sanders crowd. But what they have figured out is how to leverage, almost even manipulate the market to continually invest in what matters, large-scale infrastructure, large-scale education and skilling of their workforce. So they have figured out how to grow the economy and benefit from that growth for the public. We have not figured that out in the United States. And that's why there's almost a cartoon of Denmark or a cartoon of some of these Scandinavian countries. Oh, they just tax and regulate. Actually, they grow the economy and then have that growth benefit a broad portion of their populace.
The back end of it, how they spend it, it looks more what we would consider in this country to be far-left politics.
Absolutely.
But the front end is... is hyper free market.
Hyper free market. Yeah. These are old trading nations going back to the Hanseatic League and before. And so they really understand how to grow public and private wealth and have it work for a broad segment of the citizenry.
Yeah, so I want to come back to that, but let me jump a little bit here, because your last two books that you've written, I think, are sequenced on purpose, right?
Right.
Because the first one you wrote a few years back, and not the first one, but the ones I'm referencing on metropolitan communities, which I think was a big eye-opener. It talked about the importance of the metropolitan region from an economic, social standpoint, you name it, and the fact that people in local government see boundaries along roads and nobody else does. They live in metropolitan worlds with metropolitan economies and are largely... identified by people around the world as being in Metro Chicago or Metro
Absolutely.
Detroit or Metro Grand Rapids or wherever. And then you went a step further to localism with the new localism, which just came out, which I know is going to be the topic of your talk to all the folks here. But tell us that first book on metropolitan community, what's the important takeaway from that you see a few years out? What year did that come out?
That came out in 2013.
13, that's what I thought. Okay.
To
well, 5 years deep on that.
To some extent, it was both a statement about the true organizing unit of the global economy, which is the metropolis, not the locality, and how to think about not the perfect, but the good, right? Which is collaborative efforts across multiple sectors, public, private, civic, university, labor, et cetera, to grow your economy and have it benefit a broader portion of your citizenry. I mean, what I've done in both books, first with Jennifer Bradley and then with Jeremy Nowak, was to posit that cities and metropolitan areas are not governments. They're networks. That's why they're the last standing functioning unit in our country and, frankly, in many parts of the world.
Right.
Because governments can be hijacked by partisanship, and they pretty much are at the higher levels on a daily basis. At the city level, you get rewarded, or metropolitan level, you mostly get rewarded in your sector for getting stuff done.
Right.
You don't really get rewarded for obstructionism. So both books are really trying to explore this notion of network governance. So most of the conversation about city and metropolitan areas, can you consolidate governments? This is really, can you collaborate to compete? Can you build functioning structural networks, public, private,
and
civic
key.
Leaders?
Yeah. And especially in a state like Michigan where, I'll take an example, we're in Grand Rapids right now, you know, Wyoming and Grand Rapids for the last 40 or 50 years may have looked at each other as adversaries in economic development. Would your book originally says, you're not adversaries, you guys are a team.
Oh, you're joined at the hip.
You're joined at the hip. And somebody looking to come here is looking at the entirety of it.
Absolutely.
And it's not one versus the other. And I think that you got to unpeel the onion on that one, because that's generations and programs and everything else in terms of how we look at things.
And at the end of the day, we don't need to collaborate on everything.
Right.
Right. I mean, I think having many of these local jurisdictions does enable choice for people, but when you invest in things that cross borders, like roads, like transit, like labor markets, even housing, we should be thinking about collaborative efforts that are public, private, and civic. I don't think this is just about the public sector getting its act together, because many of these issues, when you actually look at what I would call the capital stack, how you actually finance stuff in the U.S. and elsewhere, there's an enormous amount of private and civic investment that goes into many of these transformative investments.
Okay, so we spent a lot of time looking at metropolitan regions, and then that's not good enough for Bruce. So you got to take it a step further, and you came out with a new book recently, The New Localism, which I think dives even deeper into sort of the wealth creation, if you will, and the stacking and the structure and the strategy behind. How a local community can survive in this crazy global economy. It's going to get more global. But The crazy thing that we've all been learning is that the more global things become, the more answers are hyper-local, which doesn't seem to make any sense at all, but it does. Tell us about the book.
Yeah, I think what has happened is a structural change in how we solve problems in the world. So I think mid-20th century, or let's take the 1970s, for example, when we were dealing with clean water and clean air, solutions were top-down, driven by national governments,
yep,
and driven by specialized agencies. And we had a good run of that for a long period of time. If you look at 21st
prescriptive, yeah, here's the problem. We're going to pass a law. Here's the new standard, and everybody follows it, and we'll see you again in 20 years.
And we really deified specialization. If you were a transportation engineer, you ran the roost. You know, if you had other kind of special qualities and knowledge, you were in charge.
Right.
We deified it.
Yes.
21st century, I think, is more bottom-up. It's networked, so it's not just government, but it's public, private, civic, and it's multidisciplinary. Because if you've got a congestion problem, the answer is not to widen the road. The answer is probably to rethink housing and employment location, rethink technological capacity, mm-hmm, all the rest of it. So, you know, in a networked society and a networked economy, solutions and problem solving change. So we tend to think about localism a lot as, well, national governments are dysfunctional, so cities are filling the vacuum. Yes. I think this is actually structural. I think we're creating like a parallel operating system in the world where cities are inventing, innovating, and then those innovations are adapted quickly around the world. In sort of a new Hanseatic League, essentially, a new sort of networked urban world that is parallel to the networked nation-state world. And I think that's what's going to happen in the 21st century. There's going to almost be two parallel systems in the world, the nation-state and the city-state.
How much of that has to do with in the U.S. at least, you're talking about the world, let's talk about this country, and you can extrapolate it to everybody else, but how much of that has to do with the sort of hyper-partisanship at the state and federal levels where, you know, I it's not much about governance as much as it is about partisanship and things. I think, you know, certainly there are schisms and all kinds of different things in local units, but 80% of the time they're trying to do the right thing for the right reasons and build bridges, and the other 20% it's personalities or partisanship or whatever. I think that's the reverse, if not more so, at the other levels. Is it that, or is it something deeper than that?
Well, I think the partisanship and the sclerosis and dysfunction of national government in many states has really created an opening, right, for cities and metropolitan areas to assert themselves more. But at the end of the day, you know, what you have with these higher levels of government is sort of hierarchical agencies, compartmentalized, specialized bureaucracies. And governments at the local and cities, city and metropolitan area, are more horizontal. They really are more networked.
Right.
And what I love about coming into a city and going, whether it's to the mayor's office or the head of the chamber or the head of the philanthropy or head of the university, everyone just is wandering in and out in a very sort of open and transparent and natural and organic way. Whereas at the federal level and the state government, the sectors are really separate.
Yeah.
You know, they're you're not really co-governing at the national and state level. You are at the city and metropolitan. Look at Grand Rapids. I mean, Grand Rapids is really an exercise in co-governance. You've had some major corporations, major philanthropies, good mayors, you know, all basically bringing the city back over multiple decades. And basic stuff. It's about, you know, placemaking. It's about restoration of the downtown and the riverfront. I mean, this is like, you know, urban prosperity 101, frankly, but done so well in a sustained way across multiple sectors.
Yeah, it's what they've been able to do here in so many different ways is remarkable. And we see that, we've seen a lot of that throughout the state in recent years, which has been very gratifying. How about, who do you think in the U.S. is doing it right?
Well, no,
I mean,
one's
besides here.
Yeah,
of course,
no,
we are.
Yeah, you are. I mean,
no,
look,
but if you're these people got to figure it out. Who do you think is rolling along good on this?
What I tend to look at, and the book sort of has multiple examples of this. If you think across these areas, innovation, infrastructure, inclusion, placemaking. Mm-hmm. Pittsburgh's hitting it out of the park on innovation. Mm-hmm. Now they're lucky to have Carnegie Mellon and Pitt. basically in the, you know, located next to you, you fall out of Carnegie Mellon, you're at Pitt, you know, and vice versa. Right. And that kind of spatial geography of innovation, and in addition with corporate and philanthropic and government investments over time in technologies we didn't even have names for 30 years ago, artificial intelligence, robotics, autonomous vehicles, they own like the next economy in Pittsburgh in some respects. It's so interesting. But that is an intensely collaborative place. So on innovation, I have to give it to them. I think on infrastructure, I think what Eric Garcetti has done in Los Angeles, building on what Antonio Villaraigosa has done, which is basically declare we may be the poster child for sprawl in
the
world.
Yeah, take the biggest infrastructure nightmare in the United States and do something with it,
but
right?
But we're going to invest at scale in a sustained way. So, you know, Measure M voted on the same night as President Trump was elected, $120 billion for state-of-the-art infrastructure, transportation infrastructure in our, you know, in our second largest metropolis.
Yeah. Well, and that's the power of localism too, because, you know, you mentioned the election. So in this state, voted obviously for President Trump and voted very conservatively, I guess. And there was certainly a huge anti-government message during the campaign from state House members and members of Congress and everybody else. In Michigan, we passed 86% of local millages, 86% in the same election. So people that were upset with the feds and wanted change and maybe voted for the president because of that, people that were voted members of Congress or the state Senate, the state House out or whatever, they didn't. They said, OK, you're going to pave my road, my city. I'm in. You're going to fix my park. You're going to do something that I can put my fingers on and understand. And I'm not going to send my money away somewhere and have everybody run it through programs and policies and get it back. 86%, which, you know, Americans can't vote 86% on anything. Oh, yeah, and so it just talks about that power. And obviously you see that in Los Angeles.
No, there's
as well.
A trust factor. And, you know, the poster child to some extent for smart urban regeneration is Oklahoma City, which has a succession of Republican mayors in a Republican state that consistently have voted for investments in the core of the city. And so Mick Cornett, who just tried to be governor of Oklahoma and lost, but now David Holt, you know, new mayor of Oklahoma City. I mean, that is a place of enormous vibrancy and vitality. So that's where you can say, okay, are cities and metropolitan areas partisan? No, they're just problem solvers. And they
but
see
even there
the benefit,
where you have recognized partisans, when you get at City Hall, like I said, it's still 80-20. There might be a little partisanship, but they're trying to pave the road.
They're trying to
pave the road. Trying to put somebody in the empty industrial building first and foremost, rather than play gotcha politics or get a soundbite or something. Some of that happens, you know, no question. But that seems to be sort of the breakdown, I think, that we see. And maybe we always have. It's more obvious now because, you know, we're in a 24-hour news cycle and everybody's Walter Cronkite because we got a smartphone with a Twitter account. So,
well, and the news cycle tends to reinforce this notion that the country is run from Washington, which is absurd.
Right.
I mean, it's really anti-American when you think about it. We're a large distributed federal republic. We still need a national government to do basic things, and we need states to do basic things. They set a platform for urban and metropolitan prosperity. They enforce civil rights. They enforce environmental protection. They do a whole bunch of different things. But frankly, we do not need them to solve a lot of issues that are more hyper-local.
Mm-hmm.
And by having the locals lead, I think there's more innovation in policy and practice than would otherwise be the case.
No question.
So,
multiple shots on goal, right?
Absolutely.
You need it.
Guessing
right the first time, it happens here and there, and it's wonderful, but the people who take more shots on goal are going to score. And I think that when you look at innovation, you study it, you need that, which is one of the cool things about, one of the only cool things about Michigan being in such problem spots and some of our communities being so upside down over the last couple of decades is we're trying things. And, you know, you try things, you get innovative when you're up against it. And I think there's some, Pittsburgh's obvious. I mean, Pittsburgh, I think, in many ways with the steel industry was earlier to start looking in a different direction than Detroit was with the auto industry.
That's
why maybe they're a decade ahead. And and quite frankly, the rest of the country is now starting to figure that out and with their own sectors, because those are changing dynamically as well. So
the U.S. is really quite unusual in the sense that we have dozens of places, dozens of metropolitan areas that really are global metros. Because of our advanced research universities, mm-hmm. because of heavy federal R&D that just keeps coming, irrespective mm-hmm. of who sits in the White House.
Right.
The current occupant doesn't believe in science, but the money just keeps coming. You know? So that's a platform that, frankly, the rest of the world doesn't have. And when you're in a lot of these European countries or elsewhere in the world, the capital tends to dominate. And in the U.S., a lot of our capitals are, you know, not in the major cities. So
right.
it's quite interesting to see how powerful we are because of how distributed we are.
Yeah, yeah. So where, if folks want to read more about this, and I really suggest they do if they care about their own community, they just care about sort of what's next economically. Where can they find the book? I think you're everywhere. But
I think, you know, probably
New easiest. Localism.
Yeah, the New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism. Order Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
All right.
You know, it's in a whole bunch of independent bookstores.
Great. Where can they follow your work?
Newlocalism.com.
Right.
I have a newsletter every 2 weeks, and it's just trying to figure it out. How do you fund the future from the bottom?
All right.
When, you know, the national government in many states are on a frolicking detour.
All right. That's all the time we have today. I want to thank Bruce for being here. And again, the book is The New Localism. You can find it on Amazon and other places, and go out and check it out, because what's in the book, I think, has got lessons for folks here in Michigan and folks across the country, and quite frankly, everybody. So thanks for being here.
Well, it's a great time to be here.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org. And join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.